Hello and welcome to season 2 of Long Shots, our weekly podcast. Yes, Sharad, we are back now in the business. And so season 2, episode 17, I would say this is a podcast, as you all know, where we like to talk about business, finance, and practically anything relevant from a consumer interest perspective, and often unrelated stuff we just find intriguing, interesting, and relevant. A friendly reminder to all our listeners, we are streaming on Apple, Google Podcasts, Deezer, Spotify, and practically any podcast app that you like to use. So do check our channel, do subscribe so that you get a nice notification every time we upload a new episode. So this is Nikhil Arora and I have with me Sharad.
Hi Nikhil, how are you? Happy New Year to you and all, I guess, all our listeners. It's good to be here and I'm looking forward to a lot more podcast in 2019.
Yes, sir. We kind of did our first 16 episodes. Then we thought that, you know, let's cut that to season one. Very American way of doing things.
Yeah.
Very sitcom inspired, I must say.
It is.
But I guess the gap between the two seasons was not that long, only 2 weeks. I guess.
I think that's a better thing to do rather than keep our listeners waiting.
I hope so. I hope they are as eager as we are. So, on that note, a lot of things have happened, right? I think December 3rd or 4th week was the last time we were live.
Yeah.
And since then, we had Christmas, we had New Year's. India has won a test series in Australia.
Yeah.
PM Modi is on a roll with the new things coming up every day. I've never seen the parliament so quickly mobilized to pass the 10% quota bill. No wonder.
Yeah. On top
of that, no protests there. And maybe we can start from what happened this week, Apple.
Yeah, Apple would be a very topical thing considering it always makes for very pleasant Christmas presents in the Western world.
Yes.
But clearly stock crumbling, clearly a lot of things to talk about. I mean, at the epicenter of all this is revenue guidance cut for Q1.
Right.
You and I were talking about it, and that sort of is the first time in 15 years they've made such a cut.
A very small number of $84 billion versus 91 or 92 as expected, correct?
Yeah, and as they say, right, stock market enthusiasts are overly emotional and short-sighted, so they'll start looking for signs in terms of long-term sustainability or what this signifies, but
right.
Enough for the stock to be punished.
And already I saw a lot of commentary on how this revenue size, even though smaller, is comparable to 40 countries GDP. That really juicy piece of analysis, which we find every time, you know, such kind of big numbers are being talked about. But yes, I mean, still a notable downgrade in the revenue expectation.
Yeah, I once read, I don't know if it was on Twitter or something, someone compared Apple or Amazon's market cap to GDP. I thought that was the most useless piece of analysis ever.
Yes. But I'm pretty sure it got a lot of likes and retweets.
Of course. Makes for flashy headlines, right?
Yes, it does. And the interesting thing is Apple is right now trading at 12 times earnings.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, fairly depressed compared to $1 trillion or a former $1 trillion valuation company.
Yeah.
And I guess Tim Cook in all his addresses practically threw the sink at China.
Yeah, he did. And obviously, as a CEO, I guess you got to blame external factors more than anything else. And when it comes to external factors, the easiest factor to highlight is sort of trade wars in this day and age. And obviously, he's flagging it. But I think wider consensus, you and I agree, there are more structural issues in the Chinese economy.
Right.
Be it increasing competition from local producers to just overall appetite and, you know, feature development amongst the local manufacturers like Huawei and other manufacturers like Oppo and whatnot. What are your thoughts and, where do you see this heading?
I mean, on the product end, I mean, my views on this were pretty much centered around a recent interview I watched. The Jim Cramer, the Mad Money guy.
Yeah.
So he interviewed Tim Cook, I think it was like yesterday or 2 days back, in which he was asking the exact same question that, okay, what's wrong? And in that, Tim Cook pretty much laid the line that, you know, I'm not in the business of pitching stocks.
Yeah.
I'm in the business of selling good products. And he said that Apple is still focused on innovative products, on customer experience. They have a very loyal, sticky base of users who swear by their ecosystem. Plus, they have created this entire architecture around their products, be it the App Store, iTunes, the Mac OS, which all seamlessly integrates with each other, the iMessenger. And he's like, you know, basically what the point that he was trying to make is that people think a lot before moving away from Apple products once they start using it. So there's not really much sign of worry. And he was obviously iterating that the Chinese economy slowed down in the second half of FY18. And slower than what they expected, and obviously that was accelerated by the US-China trade war.
Yeah,
and that's why they kind of saw lower than expected sales there. But I think there are a few. One can be a devil's advocate here. Obviously, innovation is a core proposition of Apple. But I think even you and I know that they don't really innovate as dramatically as they used to, right? I mean, if you look at smartphones as an industry, I mean, Apple makes $265 billion of revenue, right? Out of which iPhone is practically, you know, more than half of it. So no wonder they're dependent on smartphones, and smartphone as a sector is also slowing down. So I think they're kind of facing that external or maybe internal lack of diversification benefit as well.
Yeah, no, all true. That's also obviously a factor. And I think the other key data points here is like, first is like you said, Chinese economy was slowing down. I think it grew at 6.5% end of third quarter, which is the lowest since 08.
Right.
That's
right.
Factor number one. Add to it the fact that Apple in the last couple of years has been the third biggest mobile phone seller in China. Now it's slipped to fifth. And the top four are all local manufacturers.
Right.
So there's a slowing economic growth coupled with increased competition. That's a deadly cocktail for a company to thrive in, considering you're an overseas player.
Correct.
Add to it all the tax-related nuances, I can completely see. And then you add the point that you made about innovation slowing down. You can easily see why there is an elephant in the room that needs to be addressed.
Right.
And like you said, like China is an important market for Apple. It's about 5% of overall revenues. I don't know how much of it is iPhones. You probably know that. But it is a central piece.
It's a growth area, right? Because I guess when it comes to the Apple universe, so-called, I mean, when you look at like Western Europe, you look at US, they're pretty well entrenched there, right? They don't really see much growth there. There it's more of a cash cow kind of a play.
Yeah.
But the actual growth in terms of acquiring new customers, for that they will have to obviously move to China or India and break it big there. And these are much more cost competitive markets, as you said, right? And I mean, obviously Apple likes to take a lot of pride in the fact that they are a very premium position product, right? But probably smartphones now are such a commoditized product that, I mean, many of the people, especially in these countries, frankly, don't care if they're having a Huawei phone or a OnePlus or Google. I mean, as long as it does what they think it does, and it's cheaper than the alternate.
Yeah. And you were telling me something interesting the other day about how Tim Cook, I think in an interview, was talking specifically about India. Was it the same interview?
Yeah, it's the same interview. He was saying that, you know, we are not about to start making the cheapest phone.
Yeah.
He was very categorical in that. So he was taking pretty much the same view as Mr. Hastings, probably in Netflix, that they're not going to dilute the offering.
It's premium offering, yeah.
It's premium offering. They're going to stick to their guns there.
Yeah.
But Tim Cook also said another thing. He said that he feels that a deal might be brokered very quickly between US and China.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think this might be one of those instances that, yeah, Apple hit 1 trillion, right? Then they obviously reported a lower guidance. So the market is now overreacting.
Yeah.
But I mean, it will correct itself very soon.
By the dip.
Yeah, by the dip, exactly. So, from a stock perspective, I would not be very, very pessimistic about them. Because, yeah, it is an innovative company. They come up with new products all the time. You know, they kind of, for instance, a lot of their so-called non-incremental innovation did happen in the non-smartphone space, right? I mean, like now they're very big in wearables.
Yeah.
They're very big in, you know, watches. They're big in AirPods. So they're doing all those things. So I think the market also needs to cut a bit of slack.
Yeah.
Right. To them. But yeah, that being said, it's obviously not the same top-down leadership as Steve Jobs.
Yeah, no, of course, there's a massive difference. I mean, he's an ops guy and you can probably see the difference. But the fact that their premium positioning is at its center is, I think, very important to the culture they bring to their firm.
Right.
Which is what, I guess, top management and leadership cares about. Not how the stock swings in short-term quarterly basis. But from a long-term basis, I mean, like you said, it's just about creating that innovation angle alive. You never know what the reason it's called innovation is you can't see the next product from where you and I are sitting.
Right.
Maybe something will happen. And like you said, like probably healthcare is going to be more of a focus. So let's see how that goes.
Yeah, healthcare, payments, those are all green spaces, right?
Yeah.
And probably Apple would continue to, I think they would kind of go horizontal, you know, diversifying around new product categories rather than actually go vertical in terms of having cheaper products. They'll keep a premium positioning altogether, but just enter new correlated verticals.
Yeah, and they already have talked about getting deeper into media space,
right,
which is another interesting angle. I mean, it's overcrowded, but let's see how that unfolds. But
yeah, but I mean, with the kind of cash they have on their balance sheet, they can play that.
They can easily acquire some studios as well.
Yeah, they can do that. But you know, I mean, it was interesting that in this entire conversation, a lot of attention was on China, right? But if you look at the US, that's pretty much the counterparty in the US-China trade war thing. I feel that, frankly, China is the one who's looking much more vulnerable and at risk. US still is kind of breezing ahead, you know. I mean, non-farm payrolls hit a record high in December.
Yeah.
Most economic parameters look fairly stable, even though the markets are going quite crazy. But I think that's more due to factors like government shutdown and all the noise around China rather than what is, you know, fundamentally wrong with the US economy.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, as much as we can talk about Fed Chairman Jerome Powell, like if things are not going right, I don't think anyone would ever raise rates. So obviously they're coming from a place of some economic indicators that are going wild now. Traders and speculators can argue that, you know, it's the wrong time or the right time.
They're saying because Trump is bothering him, he's kind of trying to show his independence overtly.
Yeah. And just when the economy is like firing on all cylinders, quote unquote. But it's, you know, we can discuss rate hike as much as we want. But you're right. I agree that the fundamental problems more seem to be coming out of China than US, which will have a similar impact in terms of global economy. I mean, they're such a big manufacturing hub, a consumer hub. They just have a big telling factor in global economy. So there are more red flags there rather than US, I think.
Yeah. I mean, US, I mean, at the end of the day, Trump, you know, no matter you like him or you hate him, but I mean, I think he has realized that if the US government is behind him, he can bully his way through a lot of things, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and he's managed to pull that off in a few things as well, right?
Yeah, the analogy I make is he's the guy on the poker table with the biggest stack.
Right.
You can raise whatever you want. You can pretty much bully the table.
Yeah.
And he's using that advantage, I feel. Whether it's right, wrong, I mean, that's
not... I'm pretty sure earlier presidents also did that, but he's just doing it much more brazenly out in the open. He doesn't care about, you know, what one thinks. He has so much firepower with the US government backing him that, he's kind of managing to achieve success.
Yeah.
In some way or the other.
Yeah.
And I think this Apple, China, US narrative also kind of links very well to the Indian narrative, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think in all of this, like against the background of China, I think India is not looking so bad, is it?
No, I mean, I don't know. It's looking good, but...
Because you, I think, were checking out some... GDP numbers, right, recently?
Yeah, I think they came out with their first estimates for next year's GDP growth, and I think we're at 7.2% growth, and this is obviously sequentially higher than last year.
Right.
Obviously, these are estimates. Obviously, estimates are generally have an upwardly bias from what I've seen. I mean, so that way it's fine. But again, because of uncertainty in the global markets, especially in the global economy, China and US, I don't know how much of that is... It's not a risk-adjusted estimate,
right,
from what I feel.
But I mean, like, don't you think, like, in terms of external factors, like oil is now a bit...
Tapering off,
right? US rates are high. Obviously, that has a capital outflow effect, but that has been true for the past 6 to 7 months, right? That's not a recent... And I think internally, from a fundamental perspective, I think there have been some good signs. Like yesterday only I was checking out there were some numbers out by CMIE and they were talking about how, like, I look at credit a lot.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think because the trends in credit growth are a great indicator of what's going to happen in the next few quarters. Right. And they did a comparison of scheduled commercial banks in India and how they are lending cycle by cycle for FY 18-19 versus FY 17-18. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there's a big delta now. So it has kind of, credit movement has gone up.
Yeah.
Right. That kind of shows that there's a, the recovery has finally landed.
So this is like following the sort of handbrakes were put on because of GST and demonetization.
Yeah, so demonetization, GST, yeah. Oil, yeah. All those factors came into the picture, right? One quarter after another. And now I think with the new, obviously with management change in RBI, even the central bank is providing a much needed, I would say, fillip to the government,
yeah.
Right? So their hands are open a lot more. And in addition to that, the industry has gone through that cycle once, and now they are on a recovery route,
yeah.
Right? And the credit kind of shows that. So I actually kind of like those numbers quite a lot. So, and if you look at the neighborhood, you know, if you look at like what's happening in China, what's happening in Pakistan, in the entire South Asia or Asian domain, India doesn't seem to be that bad.
Yeah. And let's wear the optimistic hats and let's hope that it's all good in 2019. Obviously, I'm very cynical when it comes to such things because I'm worried about the macro environment. I genuinely feel that a recession is likely.
Right.
In 2019, when I said
globally.
Right. I think any one of these big boys fails recessionary environment, I think that will spill over to the rest of the world.
Right.
So I was reading this interesting article on Zero Hedge, and where, you know, I can't remember the name of the economist, IMF it was, and they were saying that we've sort of run out of ammunition to cater to the next recession.
Right.
I mean, yes, the de facto stable fallback option was hit Control P and print the notes. And
but that also we have done beyond.
We've done that fair bit. So I don't know. But again, like, I mean, we, over years, I mean, there's always been problems and we've collectively, I think, addressed it with whatever fiscal and monetary mechanism. So I'm sure we'll figure something out. But I don't know how that will impact. So let's see. But
yeah.
Yes, but yeah. Fundamentally on in India, yes. I mean, I think in the last few months, there has been a little bit of tilt from a bearish to the bullish side.
Internally, at least.
Yeah. And like you said, credit metrics. I mean, that's an area that you understand well. But obviously, credit metrics upward sloping or trending well speaks well to the overall long-term trajectory of the economy. So that's very positive.
Right.
And yeah.
But yeah, external factors is always a flip of a coin.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
You never know.
So.
Right. But I mean, speaking of never knowing things, you know, I was checking out, you know, SoftBank, right?
Yeah.
SoftBank, Vision Fund, $100 billion.
$100 billion.
Yeah,
Vision
so
Fund.
I mean, they just kind of buy anything at any price. And
and they say that they have another $100 billion fund coming up soon.
Exactly. So, I mean, there was a time when I think you could be like, all bets are off when it comes to SoftBank, right? They can kind of get into any situation. Yeah, if you want to invest in Uber, yeah. If you want to invest in Ola,
yeah.
If you want to, you know, take money from Saudis, yeah. I mean, like, they were pretty much, you know, pioneering that entire funding and financing, you know, distinct opportunities route.
Yeah.
But for the first time, in recent memory, I saw that they were, you know, WeWork, right? It's pretty much vouched as the next Uber. So they had put in $8 billion in WeWork, and they were scheduled to put another $16 billion and get a majority stake. But they ended up cutting it down to $2 billion.
Hmm.
So they can't do everything, it seems.
Yeah. So the interesting thing here is, what has changed? In what possibly has changed from that 16 billion, let's not call it commitment, but 16 billion guidance or willingness to spill out 16 billion to 2 billion? Has the market dramatically changed, or have they understood WeWork better? It's one of those things, or a mix of both?
I think it's a mix of both.
Yeah.
Because like WeWork, like, just for the benefit of everyone, WeWork is a co-share space platform.
Yeah.
Right. If I understand. And now there are two, three things, right? One is that US-based company has supposedly a heavy tech angle in it. So it's often, you know, valued as a tech company rather than as a real estate company. Mm-hmm. Probably that cycle is now turning back. And
they're
looking at it as a real estate company now.
Yeah, so it should. It's the biggest leaser in Manhattan.
Yes.
WeWork.
So no wonder.
Found that. Yeah.
No wonder. So I think people just got carried away by looking at their app or something. But at the end of the day, they are just leasing out, right?
Yeah, it's a real estate company, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So there are two factors, right? So if they're a real estate company, who are their tenants? Startups. So one commentary is that there is a you know, kind of calming down of startup activity in the US, right, which has kind of dropped the demand. And the second is that overall lease rentals have gone down, which is a strange comment on the US economy. I mean, on one end, you hear that it's fundamentally stable. But yeah, it's true that since WeWork started, this is the first time that it's going into a so-called bearish real estate cycle.
Yeah, and listen, irrespective of what the fundamental metrics say and markets aside as well, there are recession worries out there. I mean, that's when, the moment you read of any Western publication, business-leaning newspaper, you can feel that tone of an upcoming recession, what will happen. That narrative is there,
right?
How correct it is or not, but when you see or hear things like this, rental yields and bond yields and things like that, you sense that there is at least a probability of recession being inbuilt into day-to-day market forces, right?
Right.
Yes, you know, that's probably weighing as well, and maybe that's why they should build the next big facility in India.
Right. I mean, you know, in terms of SoftBank, right? I mean, the Vision Fund was supposed to earlier back the $16 billion investment. And Vision Fund, as we know, is comprised mainly of Saudi Arabia and Abu Dhabi investment funds. And they were the ones who kind of, you know, pulled back.
Yeah.
And the $2 billion that now SoftBank has put in is coming from SoftBank Corporate.
Yeah, it's not coming from the Vision Fund. Correct, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess, yeah, they are also kind of, you know, bracing for a potential recessionary move.
Yeah.
And they do understand that, you know, no matter what you might tell from a branding or marketing perspective, at the end of the day, you are taking in office spaces, you're leasing them out. And, you know, that is correlated strongly with the overall macro.
Correct. Yeah. So obviously, it will be interesting to see how that unfolds and how SoftBank sort of takes that forward. And they're so big even in the Indian tech ecosystem, right?
Right.
So, do they see real estate, let's call it, be a next big piece of their puzzle? Or I don't know, but it'll be still worthwhile to track it forward.
I mean, like when you mentioned they should probably, WeWork should probably set up in India. I don't know whether they're already there. But yeah, I mean here also in India also, when you look at rental yields, they are notoriously low.
Yeah.
I mean, most of the people in real estate actually make a gain from capital.
Yeah.
Rather than on, they don't play on the yield.
Yeah, right? No, right. Yeah.
And I think WeWork also realizes that, you know, that's the reason why they are not, you know, I was reading that, like they have three segments now. One is WeWork, which is the office rental part. Then they have something called WeLive,
yeah,
which is like a community living thing. And then the third is, they call it WeGrow, which actually is schools.
Yeah.
So they also, I think that's where they want to kind of build these three verticals and, you know, then kind of have some sort of a tech synergy across spaces. So they're like, we're just renting out spaces for different activities, you know, let's not pigeonhole ourselves into like office or whatever.
I think they want to rename the company to We Company.
Oh, okay, nice.
But it's
crafty.
I don't think it's official, but I think there is rumors that they're in the process of renaming from WeWork to We Company, just
right,
like you said, to encapsulate all those little verticals.
Yeah, but this rebranding, I think, seems to be theme of the season. I was recently reading the MasterCard. They dropped the MasterCard from their logo.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they were like, card is just one of the games now, right? I mean, they, I think, want to position themselves as a payments player or something.
Yeah, and also, like, they feel like that logo has enough power and pull in the world that you don't need the words to actually say what they do.
Yeah.
It's similar to sort of Apple and some of these people who have dropped their names as well.
Right,
because
right,
they believe
right
that their logos are so powerful,
yeah,
that they can be conceptualized in inferred without actually telling the user or the person looking at it
right
what it signifies. So yeah, it's a big boy player then.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, you know, like how brand equity works and how years of familiarity you can actually even play on these small levers.
Yeah,
you know? So that's pretty interesting. And then let's look at things a bit inward now.
Yeah,
right. I mean, in terms of our eternal favorite topic of RBI.
We always I don't think we've gone through two successive podcasts without bringing in RBI or whatever, be it related to RBI, whether it's rate increases or surplus discussion, but
right,
we've always come back to it one way or the other, and it's good that we are beginning this year with an episode where we do talk about RBI.
Yeah, I mean, they're likely to now pay a bumper interim dividend of over $4 billion to the government.
Yeah, that's 30,000 crores.
30,000 to 40,000. That's the range they have given.
What do you feel about it?
I mean, it's a multiple. It's a big multiple of what they paid last year, right?
By how much?
I think three to four times of last year. I mean, also they have set up this economic capital framework committee headed by Bimal Jalan.
Yeah, former governor. Yeah,
former governor supposed to be more quote unquote pliable. Oh, can we say that? I don't know. I mean, maybe we can say that now.
You just did. So
I just did. I didn't say hashtag pliable. So I think that it's okay. I'm safe. Right.
Yeah.
So you recall, right? I mean, that earlier the government has been at. Government has not been holding any punches against RBI. They are saying that, yeah, you need to, decrease your provisions, decrease your surplus, repatriate more to the government so that their entire fiscal footprint increases.
Yeah.
But that was a very contentious debate, led to the resignation of Urjit Patel and got replaced by a career bureaucrat, Shaktikanta Das.
Yeah, you're being nice and diplomatic by saying potentially. I would say it directly resulted in it, but
yeah,
I mean, don't have any evidence to suggest it, but yes.
Yeah, so I mean, the as soon as he was swapped,
yeah.
I mean, there has been a chain of events which have happened. Not strange, but there have been a consistent chain of events which pretty much show where this is heading,
yeah.
Right? I mean, the committee was supposed to get formed earlier as well, but it got formed. It's headed by XYZ. Then obviously, dividend spike has already been, proposed.
Yeah.
So I think RBI's balance sheet is going to trim.
Yeah. And it's sizable. Like you said, it's 3 to 4 times last year.
Yeah.
30,000 crores as such on an isolation basis probably doesn't.
So this is the dividend. So this is pre-surplus impact, and the surplus will be on top of that.
Yes, and it's sizable.
Yeah.
It's not when you look at it as a multiple, like you said, 3 to 4 times last year. Like it's meaningful, right? It's not a small little token dividend or.
Oh no! I mean, that's why. I mean, no wonder if you realize the government is now so much more relaxed about announcing new plans and new schemes, because they know that now they have the firepower to at least announce it, if not execute it, right?
Yeah.
And it's the RBI's right now is towing the government's line one way or the other.
Yeah.
I mean, no matter how much we argue about it.
And which opens up to, and I want to talk to you because you were talking about at a high level about a research paper, not a research paper, but an article that we, in fact, one of our contributors on Transfer had written.
Right.
And sort of, which is at the, at the center of it is that question, how much surplus is enough? Which is such a difficult question because there is so much of subjectivity. There's no hence proved line item that follows a mathematical formula, like the different models, different approaches to it. And, even in our ongoing debate, I mean, someone would say that we have enough surplus, that's why we can issue a dividend. Someone would say, no, it really makes you lean for any black swan event, let's call it.
Right.
So what was the article and sort of do you have any thoughts around what it
covered?
Oh,
yeah, covered? I mean, it was, even though the article was not India-centric, it was by Colin Lloyd, you know him.
Yeah.
And he was basically writing about, emerging markets in general, how they are facing the heat because US is raising interest rates. And that is like a black swan event. That is an external event for which someone like RBI should be well prepared.
Absolutely.
By actually maintaining reserves, right? So he kind of, was referencing this methodology. I think it was, kind of published by one of the state level Federal Reserves in the US,
mm-hmm.
of how an emerging market should measure reserves
and account for it.
Yeah. So how they should actually, so the methodology behind
what
qualifies as sufficient reserves. So the way he kind of looked at was that you should look at, whatever is the corporate emerging market bond index. You should look at the spread of that bond index above the 12-month Fed funds futures. We don't have to go get into that, but that spread is then correlated to what are the adequate reserves. And with that, they came up with a number of 7.1% of GDP.
Interesting.
Yeah, so they're saying that an emerging market should hold at least 7.1%. An emerging market central bank should hold at least 7.1% of surplus reserves in order to cater to any macroeconomic shock because of a US Fed rate hike.
That is interesting. And are we in the green or red on that?
We are in the red. That's the worrying thing, India. And not today, since 2013, RBI's reserves are already a fair bit below the 7.1% mark.
Yeah.
And it kind of improved slightly in 16, 17. And now again, it's going back into the red.
And it's funny that since 2013, the risk of actual US rate hikes has been non-existent.
Right.
But now that the US rate hike is real, it's not even a risk. It's happening. We're going the other way. That
yes.
seems very counterintuitive.
I mean, it's a very interesting chart. You know, I think we should put it in the comment section of the podcast for our listeners to see as well. It kind of also looks at other countries, you know, like China and Turkey and Argentina. So Turkey and Argentina are right at the bottom.
Okay.
India is, I think, fourth from the bottom or something like that. And China is phenomenally conservative when it comes to central bank reserves. They are kind of, you know, they're above 10%.
Okay.
All throughout.
Yeah.
They have not dropped even once. That is a sign of worry because as we were discussing, yeah, internally from fundamental perspective, the economy might be doing all right or better than what it was doing. External factors right now are playing in our hand, except the Fed rate hike. But say tomorrow, I don't know if tomorrow, say, crude again spikes up dramatically, would the RBI actually have adequate safety buffer to cater to that? Not like how they are going about it right now.
Yeah. No, that's it's something that's concerning.
Yes.
But, it's something that we would not know was the right decision or a good decision until...
That external event happens.
Until exactly. Like there's an external event which actually helps us validate in hindsight. But that sort of... The beauty and the risk of finance and economics, right? It's based on future events and you have to sort of, you don't get the right answer until it happens.
Right.
Everything is easy to analyze in hindsight. So let's see how that unfolds, but I am a little concerned.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's a kind of till we didn't have any data, I frankly did not have a view on this. I thought,
yeah.
Okay, nobody knows the answer, right?
Yeah.
But apparently someone does know the answer or someone has at least attempted to
exactly.
find the answer. So that obviously, you know, caters... to that concern.
Yeah.
Well, that ends it on a very, very philosophical note, I must say, Sharad. And I'm very happy to end on this note for the first episode of the season and the first episode of 2019. What do you say about that?
Yeah, no, it's been a very good start. I've always, always thoroughly enjoyed partaking in such a discussion, and it's good that we can record it and share it with others, and looking forward to a lot more.
And we encourage and pat our back ourselves. So that also goes very well.
That I always do, and we should always do that.
Well, I would obviously invite our listeners to feel free to rate our podcast, you know, give it 5 stars, comment, share your feedback openly. Let us know if we are not doing something right or if there are any issues that you feel we should cover more heavily or more lightly. And yeah, on that note, this is Nikhil Arora.
And this is Sharad.
Signing off.